This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Bullying. It's been an unfortunate part of the school culture for, well, probably as long as there have been schools. But in recent years, there have been organized efforts to end bullying, even as the practice has gone high-tech.
There's not a school in the world where you bring adolescents together that you don't have this issue to some extent, and not to be clear about what the behavior is. How are we going to prevent it, and how are we going to respond to it? Didn't make any sense to me.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we present the first installment in a five-part series on bullying. We'll also hear about a project from Cornell University that hopes to help young married people learn from older married people. Then it's a portrait of a university professor of chemistry at Tufts. And we'll spend an academic minute learning about the intricate example of physics that is the slinky. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Bullying is one of the most difficult challenges a teacher or school administrator faces. It can be the stereotypical teasing on the playground, but more often than not these days, it's a combination of face-to-face and cyberbullying. In the first installment of a five-part series on bullying, The Best of Our Knowledge's Pat Bradley looks at bullying in the schools and how educators are scrambling to keep up with technology that is making the problem even worse.
My son was a middle schooler in Vermont, and he was a victim of what we thought was traditional type bullying at first, you know, typical name-calling kind of stuff.
On October 7th, 2003, 13-year-old Ryan Halligan committed suicide. His father, John Halligan, remembers what happened.
He was picked on primarily in the beginning for his perceived learning disabilities and his lack of athleticism. You know, we dealt with it in a very traditional way, I think, as some parents did, especially back then, where, you know, you tell your kid to stand up for themselves, either walk away or give it back to him. And it got to a point where he wanted us to teach him how to fight, how to defend himself. And so he had a fight with the kid one day, put him in his place, and we thought that was the end of it. Unfortunately, my son wanted to become friends with him. And in developing that friendship, he told him something that he shouldn't have told him. And the kid took the information, started spreading rumors that my son was gay at school and also online. And he did not tell us about this. And then he spent the whole summer of 2003 trying to deal with this rumor. And part of his strategy, from what I can see on the computer, was that he approached one of the so-called pretty popular girls from the school online to try to get a relationship going with her. She ended up pretending to like him online. And then when school started up, she told him that he was a loser, that she didn't want anything to do with him, and that she was only joking around. And it was a few weeks after that my son had killed himself.
Ryan Halligan killed himself in the early days of social media, before Facebook, MySpace, and cell phones were ubiquitous among teens. His father realized then that there was a potential problem with growing online social interaction. John Halligan wrote and pushed for enactment of Vermont's Bully Prevention Law, Act 117, that creates new procedures and policies for schools.
In this time frame, you know, Ryan's school and all the other schools, from what I can tell, Vermont, when you picked up their handbook or their policy statements, they had no mention of bullying whatsoever. And that didn't make a lot of sense to me. You know, it's not a school in the world where you bring adolescents together that you don't have this issue to some extent, and not to be clear about what the behavior is, how are we going to prevent it, and how are we going to respond to it, didn't make any sense to me. So by getting this law passed in Vermont, I believe what we accomplished, and also in all the other states that have brought in laws, is that the schools are taking a harder look at this issue.
Vermont's bully prevention law was signed by then-Governor Jim Douglas in May 2004. Under a new legislative mandate, this year, current Education Commissioner Armando Villaseca formed the Harassment, Hazing, and Bullying Prevention Advisory Council. He says the group will support and guide schools as they adopt bullying prevention policies.
One of the main goals of this advisory council is to bring attention to the issue. Quite often, adults who have not been in school in a long time look at these things and maybe downplay them. So we're providing some supports for schools and also letting them know what the expectations are for all students in their school.
In northern New York State, the Safe Schools Healthy Students Coalition works to diminish bullying. One of their efforts is an I Stand Against Bullying video competition. Keysville Elementary School students won an award for their depiction of bullying in school.
That'll show her.
It starts out me typing up a message on Facebook about how Abby sucks your thumb and stuff like that.
Victoria Biot was 11 years old, in sixth grade, and a member of Students Against Violence Everywhere when she portrayed the bully in the school video.
It finally shows us in school, and everyone's pointing and laughing at her and stuff. And Abby's about to break out in tears. And Avery goes, "What's wrong?" And she goes, "She just keeps posting mean things about me on Facebook, and I can't get away from it," and stuff like that. And then Chris stands up to me and goes, "You know what, Vicky, that's not nice." And they walked into a different classroom.
Victoria, why do you think kids are out there bullying?
Because they want the satisfaction, but everything you say and do can scar a person for life.
Victoria's mother, Maxine Payette, allowed her daughter to participate in the video because she felt it would send students an important message.
You have to take the power away from the bully by standing up for the person that's being bullied. I think that that needs to be stressed to students because so many kids are afraid to stand up because their attitude is, well, I'm just glad it's him and not me. But if the kids all band together against the bully, then the bullying will stop. And I think that's the message that schools need to get out to the kids.
Sisters Cassadia and Shanzi Carter Martinez attended different schools, and both were bullied.
I couldn't grow in height. I've always been short. And so I grew everywhere else and just looked pudgier than everybody. So that just kind of became a target for all my classmates. And my mom actually caught me in the closet one day when I was actually trying to figure out how I could just end everything.
Mine started single-handedly with this one boy. I guess his whole goal was to just hurt me, and then he got the rest of his friends in on it.
And when she started directing her anger towards me, it started to catch on, and then I went to my mom. I didn't want her to get to where I got to with my bullying.
Turner Falls, Massachusetts-based The Responsive Classroom helps teachers with academic and social issues. Program developer Mike Anderson, who has been a public elementary school teacher for 15 years, says the stereotypical physical bullying is actually least common. What Anderson has noticed is exclusion, verbal, and cyber abuse between kids.
It often happens in places like the cafeteria, or out at recess, or in the hallways. You know, small mean behaviors that might go unnoticed by adults, but which can really have a pretty profound impact on how kids view school and how they learn.
The Responsive Classroom has published How to Bully-Proof Your Classroom, which Anderson notes found the majority of bullying behaviors in schools is missed.
One of the statistics is from a classic Canadian study in which kids were being videotaped at recess. And the researchers told them, "We want to see how kids play, so just go play normally." And the researchers, as they watched and reviewed the videotapes, saw incidents of bullying happening on average of once every 7 minutes. When they asked the teachers, "How often do you respond when bullying incidents happen?" the teachers said, "Nearly all the time." And in fact, they only responded 4% of the time. So I think what's so hard about this is that oftentimes what adults see from a distance is different from what's happening up close. And instead of sort of standing back and observing from a distance, we really need to get ourselves in the middle of the action so we can make sure that we're taking care of kids.
Student Victoria Biot agrees that school officials must be more engaged and provide better monitoring.
Most of it happens where a teacher can't see it. I mean, one of my older brothers got dumped in a trash can in a locker room, for Pete's sake, and there was no monitor. No one's paying attention to anything, and they're not monitoring any of this stuff.
Cassadia and Shanzi Carter Martinez both describe officials in their schools as inept when dealing with their plight.
They have things in place to help with the bullying.
The opportunities.
But if when a child goes to the administration and says, "I need help," the administration says, "I didn't see it."
When it was in fifth grade and it was first starting, I went to my fifth grade teacher, and my teacher looked at me and said, "I don't want to hear any of your pathetic excuses."
It's hard to walk by the principal of your school and know that she saw you crying, she saw you leaving school early because you were terrified to be there, and that you could have, like, died, you could have committed suicide or something to get out of it, and to know that she didn't care.
In my high school, there was always this one teacher that would stand outside of his classroom so that he could see what was going on in the hallways. I didn't see anybody else in that high school who would do that.
Mike Anderson has found that too many adults think bullying is normal behavior by youth. He believes that while laws serve to increase awareness and put protocols in place, it's parents and educators together that must act to create meaningful changes.
Kids are always going to need to sort out social struggles. Bullying is about social power. We can't think that we'll just implement a couple of good strategies and then the problem will go away. I think it's something that we'll always have to keep an eye on and make sure that we're really being proactive about.
Reporting for the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Pat Bradley.
Let's move from bullying to something a little sweeter. At Cornell University, a gerontologist is working on a marriage advice project. The project is seeking the wisdom of older adults to impart to younger generations. They want to survey hundreds of individuals and have chosen Orange County in New York's Hudson Valley as one of the project's locations. The Best of Our Knowledge's Allison Dunn reports.
Despite decades of differences and technological advances, Dr. Carl Pillemer says he has found in his research that younger people do want to get married and to one person for a lifetime, and they're looking for advice from their elders on how to do this successfully.
I guess my feeling is that even though the technology has changed, this core thinking about what makes a good marriage is pretty much the same, you know, despite 60 or 70 years of technological change.
His current marriage advice project follows an earlier project in which he says he and his researchers asked older adults about life advice in general.
I like to remind people that it's only been in about the last 100 years or so that people went to anyone other than the oldest person they knew for advice about how to live. So we're trying to bring some of that back in these projects.
This latest project focuses exclusively on those in both marriages and long-term committed relationships, including same-sex couples, and on those 60 and older.
I would add, too, that we aren't only looking at people who have been married for a long time. We're also interviewing people, for example, whose married lives may have not worked out so well, like, say, who were divorced or had a very disastrous first marriage and then got remarried, and asking them what worked and didn't work. But the major common denominator is almost everybody's, you know, over 70, and many of the people are in their 80s and 90s.
Dr. Pillemer, a professor of human development and gerontology at Cornell University, says he is getting the advice through a national phone survey, along with focus groups, which were recently held in Orange County.
And one wonderful thing that folks were able to do in Orange County was to get me together with grandparents who have custody of their own grandchildren or who are helping to rear them. And they were able to talk about their own family lives and their own marriages and what they've seen. And so that was the main reason for coming to Orange County. I also came to Orange County because it has a very diverse population in terms of income and ethnic groups. So it's kind of a microcosm of the rest of the country. And it was a great place to come to for that reason.
Denise Variano is working with Dr. Pillemer. She's the Family and Consumer Sciences Issue Leader at Cornell University Cooperative Extension in Orange County.
We've had a program here in Orange County since 1998, working very specifically with relatives who are raising children without the primary parent in the home. Sometimes it's called relative caregiving, sometimes it's called kinship care. But we work presently with well over 400 individuals, family individuals, in that capacity.
Jill Manti is a Warwick, Orange County resident who participated in the focus group, and she offers this advice.
Know someone for at least a year. People are different in different seasons. Decide what's a deal breaker for you. Don't be afraid to be with people who are different religions or different races. Those are not the problems that most of my divorced friends ever had. That was not the deal breaker. It was other communication issues.
She is celebrating her 40th wedding anniversary this month, and when asked to what she owes the success of her marriage, she replies,
I think discussion. For many years, I was afraid to say what I thought because I believed that wives should be submissive and support their husband in all things. And after a long time, I figured out that I was not really a part of my marriage. I was the support system. And when I was brave enough to speak my mind and say what I thought after my husband's initial surprise and shock, we came to a much better understanding of why we were together and what we wanted to do together. So that just goes back to the communication.
And how far into your marriage did you begin to speak up?
Soon enough.
Denise Variano says Cornell Co-op in Orange County is one of the only field sites for the project, and she is working with the county's Office for the Aging.
So we're not going to be providing a set of directions or a blueprint, but really an almost a smorgasbord of positive ideas that have helped people over time. They were able to really pinpoint the kinds of things that made a difference, like trust and honesty and just having that sense of commitment and having a positive role model in their own lives. But they were also able to point out the things that we would recommend not to do, like don't think you're going to change a person after marriage, or don't, you know, be very aware of an unequal partnership where one partner has all the power over another.
What do you hope will come from the Marriage Advice Project?
I hope that more than one person, 10 people, hundreds of people, will have a better idea of what marriage is about and what it's for, and can use the wisdom of some of us who've made it this far, whether happily or unhappily, to make a better choice.
Jill Manti has lots more advice.
Taking out the garbage may be better than a dozen roses once a year. Open your mouth and ask questions. Ask everything. Don't assume anything. Practice saying, this is what you said, and this is what I wish you had said.
Dr. Pillemer says after compiling the advice, he intends to publish a book in the fall of 2014 and create an online presence. I'm Allison Dunn.
Still to come, a professor of chemistry talks about overcoming the odds to live her dream. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1176. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. After being told as a young person that she wasn't particularly smart, Mary Schultz, now a professor of chemistry at Tufts University, set out to prove otherwise. She talks about the importance of doing what excites you and encourages women to never take impossible for an answer. Schultz received her Ph.D. in chemistry from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. As a member of the American Chemical Society, she's a counselor and serves on a number of committees, including the Women's Chemists Committee, that aims to improve the atmosphere for women chemists. She's a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. In this segment from the series Stories from the Field from the Chemical Heritage Foundation, she talks about the importance of never taking impossible for an answer.
My name is Mary Schultz. I work at Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts, Boston. I am a professor of chemistry. The story of my life is if you tell me I can't do it, I do it. And so that's kind of the way it all went. I grew up on a farm. I was the second oldest of seven children. And being a girl on a farm, you're useless. And so I was told, you know, I could go for education if I wanted, but it wasn't really important and blah, 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 blah. And so having been told that I wasn't particularly smart, I could do whatever I wanted to do. So I decided, okay, if you think I'm not smart, I'm going to do as well as I can. And so I graduated high school valedictorian, which is not bad. And then I was the first person in my family to get a bachelor's degree, and the first person in my town to get a PhD. And so that's kind of defines what I do. If you say something's impossible, that's what I'm going to be doing. I fell in love with science way back when I was probably in second grade or something, and I watched a moth hatch. I can still see that in my mind. And then when I was in high school, I took chemistry as a freshman, which of course you're not supposed to do. You're supposed to do that as a junior. And I found the periodic table, and I thought it was the most wonderful thing ever. And so that really is how I got into chemistry. You know, do whatever it is that makes you excited about the world. That's really the key, because there's so many people who go to work, just earn a paycheck, can't wait till they retire. That's really a sad way to spend your life. So that's the kind of thing, you know, like in classes, students always say, will this be on the exam? It doesn't matter if it's on the exam or not. Do you want to know it? That's what's important. One of the incidents I remember when I was a young faculty member at Tufts, and there were seven of us that were junior faculty, and I happened to be the oldest one of them. I was hired first. And we had a meeting with the provost, and the provost said, you know, you older ones should take care of the younger ones. And he was looking at the guys, excluded me from that group of the older, more experienced people, because I'm a woman. Well, you know, I sort of stood up and said, I'm here and I'm the oldest one, and they'll pay attention to me. So I think that's the biggest hurdle you have to go over. It's subtle sometimes and sometimes not so subtle. You know, and what's disappointing to me about the world is that one still has to challenge that. Don't accept that you can't do it. I just have to reiterate that. I think that's the biggest thing. Don't accept it in yourself. Don't accept it from anyone else.
To hear more from the Stories from the Field series, go to chemheritage.org/storiesfromthefield. Did you ever stop and think about the principles of physics involved in the Slinky? I didn't think so, but don't worry, someone else has. And that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. The Slinky is probably one of the most beloved yet simple toys ever invented. But as Mike Wheatland, associate professor of physics at the University of Sydney, reveals, despite its simplicity, the Slinky is capable of some complicated, gravity-defying physics.
The Slinky is a child's toy, but it fascinates adults as well. Recently, with a colleague, I investigated the Slinky version of the Indian rope trick. If you let a Slinky hang under gravity, suspended at its top end, and then release the top, the bottom of the Slinky does not begin to fall for about a quarter of a second, at which time the falling top section collides with the bottom. The bottom of the Slinky hangs in midair as if by magic. The explanation is that the tension in the Slinky, which supports the mass below, relaxes from the top downwards after the release of the top end as the turns of the Slinky collapse one by one. A tension wave runs down the Slinky, releasing the tension, and ahead of a wave front, the turns are still stretched, and so support the mass below. The bottom of the Slinky does not know that the top has been released until the wave front arrives. With Rod Cross, another physicist, I investigated the falling Slinky. Rod filmed the process and extracted data for the position of the top of the Slinky versus time. I modelled this based on Newton's second law of motion. I used an existing model from the literature, but improved the description of the way that the Slinky turns collapse. A paper on the work was recently published in the American Journal of Physics. To me, the message of the falling Slinky is that everyday objects sometimes exhibit unusual physics. Newton's laws of motion are more than 300 years old, but they can still surprise.
That was Mike Wheatland of the University of Sydney. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge. Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.